The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. Omira and Borgeson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to the Omira and Borgeson Show. I'm Kelly Omira.
And I'm Christina Borgeson. So all this talk about transgender, transhumanism, posthumanism, where did all those buzzwords come from? And what do they mean? Our guest today has been described as the world's greatest post-human philosopher. And she's here today to share the ideas and historical context that led to these terms coming into the lexicon. New York University professor Dr. Francesca Ferrando is author of the book Philosophical Posthumanism, a work that examines posthumanism and transhumanism and the profound changes related to perception, mind, body, consciousness, and spirit that will, she says, change the very definition of what it means to be human. She also discusses the key role of technology in all this. What you're about to hear is a portion of an interview Kelly and I did 2 days ago with Professor Ferrando. Welcome, Professor Ferrando. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Christina and Kelly, thank you so much for the invitation. I am so honored to be here talking to you.
You are described as both a classicist and a futurist thinker. Let's start with something real basic. What is a human?
That's a great question. Well, a human is a process, and a human is also a notion. This is why it's very important not to be too attached to the idea that we have of the human in the 21st century, because that notion is very different from the ways of who we would describe as Homo sapiens thought of themselves back in the Paleolithic time or in the Neolithic time or in the Bronze Age, etc., etc. So it is important to connect to the collective consciousness and understand what it means to be human in the 21st century, but we cannot forget that often historical occurrences, cultural ideas, are embedded in scientific notions. So it's very interesting to look at the notion of Homo sapiens and realize that it is not a neutral notion. It came out of a mind of a period in which the human was one, was white, was male, was all these things that are actually embedded in the notion of the Homo sapiens. So I would say that the human is a location, is an embodiment. We are embodied in this dimension as humans, but this notion cannot be placed in strict categories because that's not who we are. And of course, this connects to gender and race and ethnicity and everything. Okay. So I don't know if it was too vague, but
because you know, there are a lot of humans running around on the planet. And if you were to take some kind of, because yes, I agree that before, for example, Black people were considered subhuman. Women were considered subhuman, not human. But at the space where we are now, I think everybody, you know, most people would agree a human is sort of incarnate what we look like now, you know, whether male or, and it's a binary, you know, male, female, although there are some people who have both or, you know, whatever, because I want to get into the gender thing too with you. So I think most people would agree, okay, this is a human is either a male or female of various colors, you know, and look like you and me, basically.
Christina, yeah, and if I can say something about this, because I know that we also want to talk about gender, this idea that the human is male or female is a new notion. If you look at macro history, which right. doesn't mean just the history that we are taught in school, but includes the Neolithic time, the Paleolithic time, like includes the whole time that we have been around as a so-called species, which is at least 300,000 years. So right. it's a lot. So if we look at the whole history, the idea that the human is true, it's really new. It's a very new concept. And if you look at a lot of native cultures, a lot of indigenous cultures, in all of these cultures, there is this idea that the human, the most connected human is the shaman. And the shaman is neither female or male, is not even human. The shaman is the person that really understands, that can connect to any species, any energies in this planet. I want to say this because this idea that the human is female or male, it is a relatively new concept.
Well, it's very concrete. And I understand that the shaman is somebody who is connected to multidimensionality, unlike the rest of us. But the shaman also has either a vagina or a penis and basically looks like a person to the rest of us, even though this is an entity who has certain capacities that are beyond, which is like transhuman capacities, basically. But, and that's what I'm trying to understand, because there's this big fight about, okay, it's binary. The biology is male and female. And you're talking about something that is conceptually way bigger than that. And it's hard for people to get their minds around it.
Yeah, but it's also interesting because, you know, we take, again, biology for granted. But biology also is not just out there. Like, biology is a science. And if we look at the history of science, a lot of things that were considered scientific are no longer considered scientific. For instance, in the Middle Ages, angels were studied as a topic of science. Thomas Aquinas, for instance, was a big name in the study of angels. And they were wondering, are angels female or male? Do they have embodiments? These are questions that in science we don't ask anymore. We ask in theology. I want to say this because the fact of having a penis or a vagina doesn't mean that you are a woman or a man. And in this, I like to quote...
Why do you say that?
Because we talked about the human, but it goes very well with the woman or the man. So this is, for instance, let's bring to the discussion some big names in the history of gender. For instance, Simone de Beauvoir, who was very important philosopher back in the 50s in France, connected to the existentialist movement.
Yes.
And she said something that I would apply to the human. She says, someone is not born a woman, someone becomes a woman, because the woman is a cultural notion. And the same goes to the human. Let me explain a little more. So if you think, for instance, what we were saying about how a human or a woman is considered in the 18th century or was considered back, for instance, in the Paleolithic time, it's radically different. And I give you a simple example. Throughout the Paleolithic times, more than 95% of the imagery of the divine is female, but it's not a dualistic female in separation from male. It's a hybrid. The female has a beak like a bird. The female has a tail like a snake. The female is androgynous. There was not this notion of separation, of absolute dichotomies, because humans were still part of the whole natural environment. And if you're connected to everything, you can never understand existence in strict dualistic ways, because existence doesn't work that way. At the end, we're all connected, even male and female in the belly, we go through all these changes. Now, let's go more concrete into the now. Now, cultures go through many different shifts, paradigms. So we have, you know, a long time of matrifocal paradigm that we never study because does not align to patriarchal values.
Yes.
But it's there. It's like 99% of our history, we were matrifocal. Then we have a shift. The man, the male becomes also divine, which is also important. But now we are at the end of that. I see the next step, the next paradigm, which is already happening with the hybrid, the androgynous, the multi-gender. And I can understand that a lot of people are still attached to the paradigm.
What does multi-gender mean? And the reason why I'm asking you that, because I think it's important, you know, there are a lot of people who on a primal level say, okay, if I want to reproduce, if I want to have a child, I'm a woman, I have to seek out a man who has the male biology, and I have to mate with that person to have another human. Well, so I think people who are looking at that are saying, what are you talking about? And I'm trying to, you know, talk about that.
Yeah, let's say that also with ART, which is assisted reproductive technology, you actually don't need anymore another person of a different gender to reproduce. You can actually, you know, kind of self-reproduce yourself through donated sperm or whatever, you know, other kind of genetic material that you're looking for. So that's...
But you still need the male sperm.
Yeah, you still need the sperm.
Yeah, of course. I would say you need the sperm. You don't need that. Like, I don't think that we need to categorize ourselves in the sense that because I need the element from another human, then I need to see myself.
But it's a specific kind of human.
Right. It's a male human.
Sure. Of course. Out of many others. What I want to say here is...
Out of many others. What others?
So, okay. Let's go back to the idea that gender is a cultural construction, okay? So someone may have a vagina, someone may have a penis, but that doesn't define who they are.
Right.
It defines some of the experiences.
No, it defines what they are, you know, in a sense, biologically, is it not?
Look, in what sense?
Here, because you have to have certain characteristics in order for you to... the basic, most primal thing for everything, all species, everybody, is the reproductive thing. And the reproductive thing right now for humans, I mean, I understand technology is making it easy for, if a woman does not want to mate with a man, she can get a man's sperm, but there's still, it's still that male element that she needs. Mm-hmm. To get pregnant. And you see, what I appreciate about your work, saying all this very rubber meets the road concrete stuff that I'm talking to you about now, because I think that what you're envisioning and what has actually been mentioned in the past, like I'm thinking of about those Sumerian texts and the genetic experiments with the Anunnaki and all those people, with Zachariah Sitchin, and you were mentioning, you know, the lion heads on the women and so on. I see that coming. And then I see it also, I see the technology coming in to make us Borgs, like part human and part, and then we do become something else. We do become something else. I mean, to me, when they say transgender woman, to me, that's a new being. That's a different being from the regular human woman, okay, in a sense.
Well, I would say that biology is a technology of existence. So like you rightly said, in order to move on as a species, there are some techniques of reproduction that involve the combination of specific humans. But this doesn't mean that biology is an imprisonment. What I want to say here is that, for instance, if you think of reproduction and how families used to be back in time, this idea that you needed one female and one male, and you know, and from there you have children, is also kind of a new idea, because humans used to live as tribes and your children were everyone's children. Now, I'm not saying that we have to go back or forward. We need to understand that biology is never just something that is out there. It is an understanding, it has a cultural understanding. So the fact that to reproduce I need some, like you said, male elements, doesn't mean that I am a woman in the way that a woman has been constructed. Because, let me just say this, in patriarchal times, the woman is the minus. This is why I do not consider myself a woman, although I have a female embodiment and I'm beautifully happy about that. But I don't consider myself a woman because I'm not inferior to anyone, because I'm part of existence, and being part of existence, each of us is the center of existence.
But that is a cultural perception. Listen, I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that. I was brought up in Haiti. The first thing when you're brought up in a fourth world country like Haiti, you have to, as a female, you have to because you are female, you have to distinguish yourself from the family dog. Okay. So I understand what you're saying. I don't necessarily think that changes that I am female or a woman. I just feel like, as a matter of fact, I feel like one of the reasons why women have been so persecuted and why there so much effort has gone into subjugating women is because women have great powers. Women have the power of creating life and so on. And I think, but I think that's a different issue from-
But it's not, because they're very connected. They're very connected.
Okay, how, explain.
Well, so if you think about, as you say, like the power also of reproduction.
Yeah.
And this is one of the theories. It's is a theory. I'm not sure if it's a proper theory, but one of the theories that, why do we have in history, for instance, a patriarchal shift, is because, again, it is a theory, and but is once, for instance, it is understood by humans that reproduction is not just a divine a moment of supernatural powers. So there is this idea that maybe at one point humans didn't understand that human conception was done through the connection of sexual connection between female and male. The idea was that at one point the woman would become pregnant, and that's why she was the goddess. One theory is that once humans realize that, then men want to know who is their biological offspring. So instead of now having a tribe where everyone is your child because you don't know who is your child, like it's happening in, for instance, in bonobos or many other apes that are very connected to us, that we share like 98.5 of our DNA, even more with them. So this is one theory is that once humans realize that, then some men at least want to know who is their biological.
Yeah, that's why marriage came into being.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Now, I think we're at the point that we understand that, yes, you can understand who are your children. It doesn't mean that you need to be the dominant character of the whole human play theater. I think that, you know, no understanding of the human that is hierarchical, meaning that the human, there is some human who is more human than others. And this is, of course, connected to humanism. So humanism is always evoked at this great moment of a shift from theological societies where God was at the center to more humanistic society where the human at the center. That's understanding actually is not proper, but I didn't want to go into that for that. I want to say that humanism still was very much hierarchical. In fact, in the era of the humanism, we have colonialism, we have sexism, we have slavery. How is that possible? Because this notion of the human was not equal. So it's not that every human was considered a human. Some humans were considered more humans than others, and which is still happening.
Yeah, but even though they were considered more human than others by those trying to wield power, they, in actuality, we recognize that was not true. That's a function. That's an imposition of their power. That's what's going. That's like fake news. That's like telling people, you know, you're not human because I say you're not human, even though, you know, you have all the human characteristics, but you don't have my power, so you're not human. So what I think what we're talking about here.
But this is easy for us to say now that they were fake news, but people live through these for actually not only hundreds, if not thousands of years. And a lot of people have been killed, raped, brutalized because of these ideas.
I know. I guess what I'm trying to say is I think it's an actual issue of lexicon. I think a whole new lexicon has to be put forward to really be more precise about what we're talking about here. Because I do believe in the future, the human is not going to be anymore the Homo sapien. The human is going to be a lot of different things, and because of the genetic engineering, because of the implanting of chips or whatever to make them super humans. What is the metahuman and all that? I see that very clearly, and I think that a lexicon has to be developed for all the different types of entities we're talking, because after all, aren't we just talking about vessels containing energy?
Well, I would say that words create worlds. Now my pronunciation here is a little off because I'm originally from Italy, but W-O-R-D-S, words.
Words, yes.
Create words, W-O-R-L-D-S. Oh, so the idea is that we live in the world that we construct to our understanding.
Yes, we create our reality through that. Yes.
Absolutely. So I absolutely agree with you that we need a whole new set of words and to understand the reality as it is now. And to me, that binary female, male, woman, man doesn't work anymore. I was very happy to see... recently went for a driving license here in New York State. And one of the new options that you can have, it's F, like female, M, like male, and X. And I chose that.
What's X?
X, like everything else. Whoever doesn't consider themselves neither one or the other. And I was very happy because I know that maybe if I'm driving in a state that maybe doesn't support these ideas, maybe they're going to give me a fine even if I didn't anything. You know, like I know that it has some other aspects to it, but I was so happy to support it. And of course, I choose that X because I don't consider myself one or the other. I am everything. I cannot categorize myself in a strict binary that is not only a binary, but is a hierarchy because we live in a society that has been historically.
But the hierarchy is different from the biology. The hierarchy is a framework. It's a concept. It's an imposition of power by, you know, horrible people.
Well,
but know, and the biology is different because if you get arrested today on the side of the road, what do you think that cop is going to say? Whatever you want to call yourself, he's going to call in and go, you know, I just arrested a white female going 95 miles an hour in a 30 mile an hour zone. That's what he's going to say.
Yeah, and I would not agree with the description terms that the police person give about me. And I have the right to say that I'm neither white nor a female because I do not consider myself that way. But he or she or they are free to call me whatever they want, you know. But I think that there are also rights of recognition of who you are. And I think those rights need to be respected. But so then if it's a police person working for the government, working for us, paid with tax money, then this person should know better how to describe people to a wider range of terms.
Okay, but let me explain what the other thing that I think that this situation creates is there's a lack of mutually agreed upon by everybody, you know, societies, whether, you know, on a local level or a state level or a planetary level, there are certain things that everybody agrees on at the same time so that things can make sense, you know. For example, time. We all go, you know, the clock goes 1 through 12, a.m., p.m., whatever. We all agree on that. If we didn't have a clock, we could never even get together at the same place at the same time. You know, all these things is like, it would be chaos. And I think, like, when I look at, and I'm being honest, because I think what you've done is brilliant, but I think that there's the future thing, I get it. But for now, if I have to look at one entity and call that entity a they, first of all, I have no idea about that entity thinking they're a they, because I'm only looking at one entity when I see that entity. So,
but Christina, are we one? Because if you think about it, even biologically speaking, since we were talking about biology, we are assemblages of microorganisms. We are not one, but we are billions of entities. So this idea of what is an individual, that's why I like myself to use the pronoun they. And people can call me whatever, she, he, it, I don't care. But I like that because it really reflects who I am. I am many, and I was different 10 years ago, and I'm different now. But apart from that, my body is different, and all the microorganisms that are part of me are billions and trillions. And so I think that they reflect much more who I am, and that's why I use this pronouns. But don't get offended.
But that's because you have multidimensional awareness. Most people don't have multidimensional awareness.
I have a question.
Of course, Katie.
Okay, so yeah, I'm listening to all this, and it sounds to me like this is an evolutionary change, and not, I don't mean evolutionary in the way of, you know, Charles Darwin, not that way, but evolutionary as in whenever there is an evolutionary change, it is a very long, slow process. Okay. Millions of years before we got thumbs, okay? Or, you know what I'm saying? So to say that, the humanism is going to change because we maybe don't call ourselves her or him, are we at a stage right now in 2022 where and I think evolution requires a necessity. I think that's why there are evolutionary changes, okay? Out of necessity, either biologically or you know, whatever. So why now? Why is this? I mean, is there a necessity in the environment that everything's going to, people are going to change and we're going to put, you know, things in our brains? What's the necessity?
That's a very good question. Well, first of all, I would like to say that humanism, it's very connected to anthropocentrism. And it might sound a little of a big word, but it means having the human at the center of existence. We think the human as the most evolved animal, the most intelligent one, and all these other things. Now, I think that the era in which we live, which is defined as the Anthropocene, and by the way, anthropos in ancient Greek means human. Now, the Anthropocene is the era in which we now recognize that human behaviors have a direct impact on the planet as a whole. So we're seeing climate change, we see pandemics, we see global warming, all these aspects. And until 50 years ago, 100 years ago, were considered outside of human power. Now we know that we are part of that. Now, if we want to survive as a species, which is a choice, we don't have to survive. We might get extinct because of our own action. But if we want to survive as a species, we really need to change attitudes right now, or we are in a suicidal path. So to me, like you were saying, is it necessary? Of course it's necessary if we want to survive as a species, because this idea of decentralization that we were talking about, male, but could be hetero, can be many things, including human. And it is all connected to the hierarchy at the very, very top gets into the human, and then it gets even more diversified to the point that we have a small groups in human that are really considered humans. But this is a bigger hierarchy, a larger hierarchy. And so you have the human that are considered better than non-human animals, and the non-human animals that are considered better than plants, and blah, blah, blah. But that's a really misunderstanding of the planet.
If you want to hear the rest of this interview, go to the Whistleblower Newsroom radio show. That'll be up on BitChute. And don't ask that question with Kelly O'Meara. She'll post it on her channel as well. You're on BitChute too, right?
Yes, Kelly? Yes.
Yeah, so you can listen to the rest of it on BitChute. It's pretty interesting and it gets pretty heated. Anyway, what's next, Kel?
Well, as of at 1 p.m. tomorrow, if you're joining us, the O'Meara and Borgeson Show will be covering a Maine Medical Board of Licensure hearing to decide the continued suspension of Dr. Merrill Nass's medical license for, quote, public dissemination of misinformation regarding the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic, unquote. Dr. Nass is a physician who has been successfully treating COVID patients and has also documented in detail the many illegal measures taken to suppress the use of less expensive, effective drugs for treating COVID, including ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. Interestingly enough, in September, the licensing board dropped all charges regarding the so-called, quote unquote, misinformation that she was putting out. Dr. Nass's license was suspended in January of 21 without even a hearing, accusing Nass of, quote, unprofessionalism and, quote, disruptive behavior based on her comments of the government's COVID-19 policies and early treatment protocols. Dr. Nass has never had a malpractice suit brought against her during her 40 years of practice. And the remaining charges the board will address deal with complaints from two people who read something on the internet that she apparently said that they thought was misinformation, and two others from like a doctor and a midwife who apparently were unhappy with Dr. Nass's prescribing of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. You know, here's the rub. Along with losing her license without a hearing, Dr. Nass was requested to undergo psychological evaluation, implying that she somehow was mentally impaired for treating these patients with something other than the prerequisite government, you know, policies. She refused. The facts are clear. Dr. Nass has not harmed a single patient. None of her COVID patients were among those making the complaints to the board. And any reported misinformation that Nass was accused of has since been dropped from the case. We interviewed Dr. Nass a little while ago, Christine and I did, about these charges. And here's what she had to say.
Before we go to that clip, let's take a quick break. This is the O'Meara and Borgeson Show on TNT Radio Live. We'll be right back.
Hervoy Morich on TNT Radio.
In South Korea, there was a missile crash during a drill with the U.S. The malfunctioning weapon landed inside an Air Force base, and some people freaked out and thought it was an incoming attack. At the same time, we've got North Korea lobbing missiles over Japan. So this is how world wars start. So North Korea lobbing test ballistic missiles over Japan, while the U.S. is doing these crazy missile tests in South Korea. Seriously, it's just frightening situation.
Hervoy Morich on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The story behind the biggest election takeover in history.
We're only now being able to finally confirm exactly how this worked.
Mark Zuckerberg and his wife are donating more money to local governments ahead of the election. $100 million on top of a $300 million gift.
The most money any individual has ever spent to win a presidential campaign in the history of our country.
The election was bought way before Election Day.
They stole it fair and square. They changed the voting rules in the middle of the game.
A nation divided, rigged.
It was a rigged election. People have to find out what happened.
At SalemNow.com.
This is today's News Talk and the Voice of Freedom, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the O'Meara and Borgeson Show. We're going to go ahead and play that clip now of Dr. Meryl Nass and her explaining these charges against her.
What I know of is that there began to be a national movement by medical professional nonprofit organizations. By those, I mean the American Medical Association, some of the specialty boards, in other words, the Board of Internal Medicine, the Board of Pediatrics, and an organization that basically services state medical boards. State medical boards are the only entity with authority over doctors' licenses. And they are comprised in every state. Every state has its own rules, but they're comprised of a staff that is paid by the state, and doctors and maybe non-medical professionals, and perhaps, in my case, physician assistants. And this board's job is to protect the patients of the state from physicians or physician assistants who are not capable of practicing good medicine. In the case of Maine, they send out a newsletter, I think every quarter, and they list the doctors who have been punished by having their licenses removed or being put on probation or something else. And almost invariably, these are due to substance abuse issues. Not in every case, but it probably at least 90% of the cases. In my particular case, there were no patient complaints. There were four complaints, two by strangers, regular people who saw me on the internet say something they didn't like and reported.
Wait a second. Hold up now. You didn't even treat these people? They weren't patients?
They never met me. I don't know them.
Okay. All right.
They saw something on the internet and they didn't like it and they decided to complain to the board. First one actually wrote a very sort of legally complex document about, I've never met Dr. Nass. I don't know any of her patients. You know, I saw this and this is what I, you know, blah, blah. So those were the first two complaints. And then the board, I think, went looking for complaints because there had in 41 years practicing medicine, there'd only ever been one complaint previously from the son of a patient, and it was investigated, and they found that I had treated the mother perfectly, and the son apologized to me afterwards for having made the complaint. So that's 41 years. And now all of a sudden, the board, within a period of 4 months, gets four complaints. So how does that happen? So the next two complaints were doctors who have never met me, who don't know me, but each of them, well, one was a nurse midwife and one was a doctor, and each of them wound up treating a patient that I had treated. And one was a woman delivering a baby who had had COVID during her pregnancy, and I treated her with hydroxychloroquine. So that midwife reported me, even though the patient was fine, the baby was fine, nobody had been harmed, but reported me simply for having given her hydroxychloroquine. And in the other case, a patient who I had treated with ivermectin, who subsequently wound up in the hospital, was treated by another doctor, told the other doctor that I had given her ivermectin. The doctor felt compelled to report that I had treated this patient with horse paste. So those were the four complaints. And then there was a fifth complaint, which the board called a complaint. And that was the one that I had made when I told the board, you have put me in an untenable position where I was forced to either basically protect a patient or protect myself. And I decided to protect the patient. And I, after calling in a prescription for hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, I notified the board that when the pharmacist called me back, I said it was for Lyme disease, because had I said it was for COVID, the pharmacist would not have dispensed it. And that this was done, and the reason the pharmacist wouldn't have dispensed it was not because there was a rule, regulation, or law prohibiting them from dispensing it. Actually, in my state, the governor said, and the Board of Pharmacy have both specified that it's okay in legal documents, guidances they issued, that it is okay to dispense and prescribe hydroxychloroquine for acute COVID, but not for prevention. And they did that in April of 2020.
Wait a second here.
Yes.
That's a little suspicious now, isn't it? Because isn't hydroxychloroquine effective in early COVID, but not in late COVID?
Absolutely. Yes.
Do you think they did that on purpose?
Yes.
That's so evil.
Well, let's not even go into that now. I mean, we did talk about that in an earlier show about the suppression of hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah, but to actually say, yes, you can use it in the late phase when they know it doesn't work.
Now, that happened in some other states. For instance, New York, which said you can't use it in outpatients. You can only use it when patients are hospitalized, when it no longer works. But in Maine, I am allowed to prescribe it the day, or I was until my license was removed, the day somebody becomes sick, but not the day before. So they can't have it in their house waiting until they get sick. And they can't take it weekly for prevention, as many people do. And it's apparently pretty effective that way. So anyway, that was an April 2020 guidance almost 2 years ago. Subsequently, someone at the state level has frightened the pharmacists into not dispensing it without issuing a written guidance. So there's no law, no guideline, no rule or regulation, but they all know that if they dispense hydroxychloroquine for acute COVID, they may be investigated and they could potentially lose their licenses. So they won't. And I've had several pharmacists basically beg me to prescribe it in a different way so that they could evade being investigated. So I've been asked by pharmacists to say that it was for a different diagnosis than COVID, or to prescribe it for a different period of time so it would appear that it was for lupus or something else. So, I mean, the pharmacists are very, very aware of this problem. We're all dealing with it, but what I think is so insidious is that the governmental agents were the only ones who have authority over the pharmacies, chose to do this in an underhanded manner without putting it in black and white.
Now, what government agencies are you talking about, and what exactly did they do to make this happen?
Well, that's it. They didn't put it in black and white, so I can't tell you. They made all the pharmacies frightened to dispense. They somehow have had the pharmacists ask, what is the reason you want this drug, hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin? And if you want it for COVID, we're not dispensing it. Now, there's no rule anywhere that says that should happen.
But where did this edict come from? It had to come in an email from someone or a letter from someone, didn't it?
Christina, we are living in very dangerous times. It is it would have been against the law for them to write it. This is a legal drug. This is a fully licensed drug. I and other practitioners are fully licensed. According to U.S. law, we have the right to prescribe it, and the pharmacists have the right to dispense it. There is not, and so what has been done is illegal. That's why it's not written down.
I'm just curious, like, did you ask a pharmacist, well, who called you and told you not to do this?
I have talked to a few of them and heard different stories. So I was told that early on in the pandemic, they were told to screen all the prescriptions for chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and azithromycin. Later, they were sent a notice from the CDC about how ivermectin could poison people, although the two cases that CDC cited were one person who got it off the internet and one person who used an animal ivermectin product. So CDC didn't have an example of an actual prescribed drug harming anyone. But one of the local pharmacists who I know, who is a recent member of the pharmacy board, told me when he got that letter from CDC, he knew he needed to stop prescribing ivermectin. Okay? So he got the message, even though it was written between the lines.
Right.
And he called me and he sent me over a copy of the letter he had received from the CDC. And then that was in August, late August, and in last year, and in late September, the Maine Pharmacy Board basically sent a letter designed to frighten pharmacists, but without saying anything specific. So what it basically said was, you know, people can be harmed and blah, 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 and therefore we want you to screen the prescriptions and only dispense for legitimate purposes.
So this is the federal of state medical boards? Is that
okay? Okay, so of the things I just said, one came from the federal CDC, one guidance to all pharmacists, and the other came from my state pharmacy board to Maine pharmacists a month later, telling them only to dispense the drug for legitimate purposes. Okay, so it didn't say what not to, why, when, how, what the punishment would be. It was a veiled threat. So that's what I want to make clear. It's hard for people to understand that we're operating now on the basis of veiled threats rather than legal measures and things written down in black and white. Okay. To get back, so when I started this discussion, I said that various nonprofit professional medical organizations all started issuing warnings at the same time as these last two documents came out. In late July, August, September, these organizations started issuing warnings that doctors could lose their licenses or lose their board certifications if they prescribed ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine incorrectly, if they said negative things about vaccines and encouraged patients not to receive COVID vaccines, or if they spread misinformation in general. None of them specified what misinformation was, or what subjects were particularly prone to misinformation. They were very broad statements, and I found them interesting because none of these nonprofit organizations has the authority to remove a doctor's license. One of those organizations was the Federation of State Medical Boards, which, as I said, services the medical boards. The medical boards do have the authority. This organization provides them with training, education, awards, you know, tries to keep what they do somewhat systematic and uniform. All of these organizations are what I call bloated nonprofits. Their CEOs earn about $1 million or more a year, and they solicit grants from pharma and from the CDC and similar entities to carry out projects on their behalf. Okay. Now none of them I can't get the tax returns of any of these nonprofit organizations for last year because it's too early in the year. So I don't know why they all at the same time started issuing warnings and threats, but they did. I wrote to the American Board of Internal Medicine last fall and said, what do you mean by this? What is your authority to issue these threats? What do you mean by disinformation? And they didn't answer me. And then in November, my own medical board sent out such a warning, October, November, sent out such a warning to doctors in my state. And I wrote to them and said, under what authority are you going to regulate free speech? We have a First Amendment, and how are you defining misinformation? What statute are you using? And of course, they didn't answer me. And they went after me at that point. But I think I was already in their sights because I'm very active in writing and speaking, and I've been trying to clear up official misinformation since the start of the pandemic. So, I've written scientific articles on masks and on case definitions and the number of cases, the number of deaths, number of hospitalizations, and how those numbers are not necessarily accurate, on problems with the PCR tests. I've done a lot of, public education.
You wrote that one article about the massive corruption of the suppression of the
The hydroxychloroquine.
Point, and I reckon, and you literally list, I don't know, it's like 60-some ways. 58 ways that they have systematically and corruptly suppressed those drugs. It's an amazing article. It's just, they do it this way, this way, this way, this way, 58 of them. And you look at it and you say, well, this is a massive conspiracy. It really is, to keep these drugs from getting out there. So let's get back to, so you get this letter from them. And I noticed that, they make their complaint against you public. And I noticed the complaint itself is simply, this is what's so nefarious about it. You're putting out disinformation about COVID, which means you're crazy. And that's the only thing in the statute that they're trying to use, or the regulation that they're trying to use, that they can use, because it's obvious that you're not a drunk or a drugged out person, whatever. So they have to call you crazy. And what they list is a series of statements that you made from, based on your research, which, these are articles you wrote not while you were treating patients or to treat patients.
Correct.
when I say that, while the patient was in your office or while you were actively dealing with a patient, you did this on your own time. This was your research and your private life and so on and so forth. But they have plunked this in the middle of your practice, and then, of course, they mention these complaints against you that you gave ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. So it becomes so Orwellian in a sense, because they're suppressing these things. They have the orders to suppress. So now they have to come after you and your practice and say, well, this woman is treating these people. And so my first question to you is, all these patients that they're talking about in their document, the first one, not the one where they want you to appear for a medical evaluation by their own psychologist, so you can, you know how that's going to turn out. it's just nuts.
And I had to pay $2,100 for the privilege. They said, bring $2,100, that's what it'll cost you to see the psychologist.
You haven't seen that psychologist yet, right?
No, because my lawyers filed, a motion for an injunction against it. So, and that hasn't been heard. We haven't gone to court, but I still may be required to do so.
Why?
Well, because the board has a statute, which my lawyers feel is unconstitutional, which says that it's a privilege to practice medicine in Maine, and therefore every doctor is subject to being ordered to have a medical or physical evaluation at any time. And you either go, or if you don't go, we consider that an admission that you have the condition. Now, in my case, they didn't actually, nobody's made an allegation that I have a condition. That's the funny thing.
They've got an apples and oranges thing here because you're being sort of accused, I would say, of mental instability, but they're not giving examples of your mental instability. They're just giving examples of things you have said in articles you've written about COVID, you know, COVID-19 issues and vaccine issues. So I don't understand how that can even be a tenable submission on their part to be acted on.
Right. I don't think it is, but there's no due process involved in that statute. So there was no way I could dispute it within the system except to ask for an, go to court and ask for an injunction. No way within the state, you know, administrative procedures was there a method by which I could dispute this, even though they have no grounds to order it.
But who oversees this board? I mean, what do you mean nobody oversees the board? The governor,
the legislature.
The legislature, Maine legislature oversees them?
Potentially, but they don't. I mean, the Maine legislature basically leaves them alone. The governor leaves them alone. The governor can appoint members, and then there's a staff. Very hard to take away the jobs of the staff. They're state employees.
Well, has the governor been apprised of this? I mean, it's really an abuse of their whole process, you know.
It is an abuse. I found out that one of the legislators has asked for meetings with the governor, was told to discuss my case. Found this out afterwards, and when he showed up, he was given an appointment to see the governor. When he showed up, there was no governor; there was an aide.
That's bizarre. Why is that? So the aide,
because the governor does not want to discuss my case. The governor is perfectly, who is a, you know, strong Democrat, is perfectly happy to use my case as an example to scare other doctors around the country.
So that was Dr. Meryl Nass explaining to Christine and I what her situation is that she's looking at tomorrow during this hearing. Chris, you have any thoughts on what's going to happen tomorrow? I mean, I was looking at this and I think, if anything, this is the medical community sort of taking orders from above, weeding out the malcontents, you know, those who don't toe the line with the official, you know, government prescribing, and the hell with healing medicine. I mean, that's what it says to me.
Well, basically, they've suspended her license, not for the way she practices medicine. I mean, that's the bottom line right there.
Right.
But the thing is, Meryl is going to be the first to testify tomorrow. So it'll be very interesting what her lawyer is going to ask her to suss out this information that she has given us. Because the issue here is, did she malpractice because she, or is she crazy? And as a result of her craziness, did she malpractice by putting disinformation about COVID, by publishing disinformation on COVID under her name in her own private time?
Look, you and I had this discussion last week when we talked to the attorney, the constitutional attorney, Jonathan Emord. I mean, this is off-label prescribing, off-label, okay? It happens every single day. The biggest cases they're trying to stop doctors from prescribing when they're not allowed to do that. Doctors have a right to prescribe off-label.
But they didn't even have a case where they could say, hey, you gave this patient ivermectin for COVID, and now he's dead.
Right.
I mean,
no.
Nothing like that. Nothing. Nothing having to do with the treatment of patients. That's what people really have to keep in mind. So now you're a crazy doctor. I don't know if the lawyer is going to go for that, but, you know, they're going to have to prove to me that what I published is disinformation. Because that's what you're dragging me in for, even though it is besides the point, but it could show you know, bad intention. We only have a minute left.
I don't think so. And I think that this really is, she needs to bring this in the forefront in her hearing, because they don't have a right to tell her what she can and cannot prescribe. This is just ridiculous. I can't believe this case hasn't even gone to the courts yet about doctors being told how to prescribe medications that are fully approved by the FDA.
Yeah, but it's specifically not approved for COVID. And they added, they slapped all that stuff on, you know, fairly recently. So obviously there's an agenda afoot. And she
it's going to be interesting.
Up.
It's going to be interesting tomorrow.
Yeah, it really is. I can't wait to hear what happens, because I think Meryl's case is very important. Very important, because she's been out there. She's been out there. Well, we'll see you tomorrow, folks.